cryptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords, Field Major Styer of the Sontaran Empire, and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels, alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, though we are only linked to the past, may be for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Sitting out the apocalypse today is Stephen Hatcher. Well known in UK fandom, he's the man behind Derby-based convention Hooverville and has also helped organise events for Big Finish and the Doctor Who Appreciation Society. In addition, he's a writer, having penned several short stories for the Big Finish Productions Short Trips anthologies, as well as editing the 2018 charity anthology Time Shadows Second Nature. Stephen, hello.
Hello, yes, Time Shadows Second Nature. Sorry, hello, Ian.
Hello.
Time Shadows Second Nature, which lasted about 2 weeks. We were one of the the charity anthologies that all of a sudden there was a bit of a craze on to shut people down, and we got shut down. We'd spent about 2 years preparing it, and it was shut down after about 2 weeks.
Oh, so, I didn't know that. I'm sorry. I just got the info off TARDIS Wiki.
Oh, yeah. No, it makes it one of the most valuable Doctor Who books out there, as it happens.
But... Oh, wow. But the BBC closed you down.
Well, somebody did. We don't know whether it was them or who it was, but because you can't find out who's closed you down unless you pay. You have to. I think you have to go through a lawyer or something to actually find out who's closed you down. So you just have to take it. Yeah, that's the end of that. It was one of those things. And I've been lucky in recent years because I'm fiction editor of Cosmic Mask, the Dwas online magazine. So I've been able to reuse a fair few of the Time Shadows Second Nature stories in that, which were really good stories. Really pleased with those stories.
And as I think I've said when we chatted at Hooverville, I'm after years of being a Big Finish fan, I'm finally a Big Finish writer. You're well known as a Doctor Who fan. Where does your to go back to the beginning? Where does your relationship with Doctor Who start? Is it childhood, like most people?
Sort of. It's because I was born in 1958. Mm-hmm. So I was old enough just about to have watched it all from the beginning and didn't. to be fair, Ian, it's a story I've told a fair few times before. When I was young, Saturday evenings every week was go to my gran and granddad's house. Always. We used to go there for tea. We would stay there all evening while my mum and dad and my uncle and my aunt would go out to the pub, and they'd leave us with my gran and granddad. See? And my granddad had this peculiarity. He was a lovely, lovely man. He really was a lovely man. But he would never, ever watch BBC. He was totally addicted, not addicted, but he would only ever watch ITV, from the wrestling in the early evening, which he absolutely loved. And he would sit there. His armchair would be right up to sort of the side of the television, and he would sit there and he'd be slapping his leg while the wrestling was going on and calling out for Mick McManus or Jackie Palo or whoever was involved that day. ITV would always be on every day of the week, every night. It never changed. Pretty much the only time I ever saw Doctor Who during the 60s was as if I was ill, or if my brother was ill and we didn't go up there. So it was a rare occurrence. I have a pretty clear memory of seeing what I think was episode one of The Web Planet. I remember that quite clearly. And I've got a sort of a memory of watching an episode which involved a group of fellas in what looked like Elizabethan dress, clustering around a queen It's the massacre. It's got to have been the massacre episode one. So I can sort of remember that, but not much else during the '60s. And this went right through to, well, it was 1972, which I think we're going to talk about in a bit.
Well, I always wonder about what order to put things in, and I've correctly guessed that your childhood early one would be 72. But I was wondering because one of your other ones is in the '60s, so I was wondering.
Yeah.
I was wondering if maybe I'd missed wrong, but you, because with your first choice, the Sea Devils, you very specifically said the Christmas 1972 omnibus.
That's it. Well, again, this is exactly right. And again, it's related to me gran and granddad, sort of, because Christmas time was always spent with me gran and granddad.
Oh, no.
which was great. No, that was great. I mean, we the whole family gathered at me gran and granddad's, and we would be sort of locked down for the whole of the Christmas period, and the mini snooker table would come out, and it would be Morecambe and Wise and all the early 70s Christmas. And, you know, I'd be upstairs with my Goon Show scripts, books, that or whatever I'd got for Christmas that year. And one year I had the making of Doctor Who, the Terrence Dixon and Malcolm Hulk. Well, the first edition, which is Malcolm Hulk and Terrence Dix, I think. That's the second edition where they changed the names around. So I had that one year. So any road up, we always used to go home. We used to go there on the to my grand's. It was in the same town, by the way. It was the other end of the same town. I was brought up in Warwick, and we were one end of Warwick. They were the other end. And we would go there on Christmas Eve, and we would sleep on a variety of sofas and beds where the mattress had been taken off and put on the floor, and somebody was on the bed base and somebody else was on the mattress on the floor, and all this sort of thing. Camp beds were a great innovation at one point. We would stay there until the 27th, and the 27th of December, we would go home, and that would be it. That would be Christmas over for the year. There we are. And that would be the end of the excitement. Apart from one year when I was 14, 1972, and we went home, and what should we do for the rest of the afternoon? Put the telly on, and there was the omnibus repeat of the Sea Devils, which I hadn't seen during the initial run of that season. I didn't see that season at all. So this was my first sight of it. I knew Pertwee was the Doctor. I'd met John Pertwee before then. In the summer of 1971, I think it was. The posh school down the road. I was at the local junior school down the road. Oh, no, I wasn't. I was at grammar school by 1971. I beg your pardon. So not my school. Down the road from where I lived, there was a preparatory school, a boarding school for posh kids in blue blazers, and they used to do these summer fates. I think they did them 2 years running, and they had Wendy Richards. No, not Wendy Richards. What am I talking about? Wendy Craig. They had a different Wendy. Mm-hmm. They had Wendy Craig opening it one year. And then the following year, it was advertised as opened by Doctor Who. And it was Pertwee in full costume and all the rest of it. And he was going around the school field, visiting all these stalls, followed by a gang of us lads, because they would allow the riffraff in to spend money for their summer fair, you see. So I'd met Pertwee, but I'd not really seen him playing the Doctor at this stage. I remember when I met him, my most overriding concern was to ask him the question when the Navy Lark would be coming back on. So, so there we are. So anyway, 27th of December 1972, and we got home, and there was the Sea Devils, and I absolutely loved it. And that really was the start for me of an interest in Doctor Who, I suppose. From then on, I got to watch it, because I'd say, look, seriously, I want to watch this. And I don't know whether I'd just never asked before or what, but yeah, watch it, no problem at all. Yeah, you don't need to watch that, Grandad. Steve wants to watch the other side. He wants to watch Doctor Who. Okay, fine. This would have been 70, yes, you'll probably put me right, 73, so the Green Death, That was that 73, I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And school gave us the English homework of write a report of something you've watched on telly over the weekend. And I did a little write-up of the first episode of The Green Death. So that'll be the first time I ever wrote about Doctor Who.
Oh, wow.
So I was 15 then.
I'm
nearly
still
15.
Going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lovely story.
June 73.
June 73, there you are. So yeah. So just those 6 months later, by then I was watching it regularly. But the Sea Devils in particular I loved because it was the sea. I mean, I lived, as I say, in Warwick, which for those who don't know British geography is right slap bang in the middle of England. It's about as far away from the sea as you can possibly get.
Mm-hmm.
Before I'd been born, my dad had been regular Navy. He'd spent something like 5 years in the Navy in the early 50s. And he was always telling us his tales of life at sea, as it were. So I always had a fascination for the sea. And there we had the Navy fighting sea devils alongside Pertwee's Doctor. What wasn't there to love?
That's a great serial. I mean, there's a reason it gets repeated almost too much. When it was on at the BFI, it was like, I can see why they're doing this. It's a really popular choice from that Blu-ray. But it's also the one everyone's seen over and over. But there's a reason for that, because it's so good.
Well, it's because it's a sequel to The Silurians of a few years earlier. And certainly a few years ago, few years ago, there was very much a feeling, I think, amongst fandom that The Silurians was the better story and The Sea Devils was the inferior rehash. But I think that opinion has changed now, because I think Sea Devils has definitely gone up in people's estimation. Yeah. And the look of the Sea Devils and the string vests. That's the point where you realise that the first lot of Silurians that the Doctor meets were actually some sort of bizarre nudist colony of Silurians who were wandering. it's a great design. It's a great story. The Master's fantastic in it. Roger Delgado. Here's the bizarre thing. I didn't see the Sea Devils then again after that omnibus repeat until I started getting older VHS tapes in the early 90s. It was repeated, of course, wasn't it, in one of the runs?
Yeah, I've still got 92? Mine recorded off the telly VHSs of that one. It's probably the first Pertwee I saw.
And the odd thing is that I'd remembered the Sea Devils, I'd remembered the Navy and all that. I'd completely forgotten the Master was in it. And he is... Delgado is fantastic in it. Absolutely superb. I was lucky enough to choose this, The Sea Devils, as the story that I did on Toby Haydock's podcast. I love talking about it with Toby and having him pick his things on it as well. So,
Sea Devils. It's one of my favorites. I love Clive Morton as Trenchard.
Yes.
There's just something about that sort of, it's very Malcolm Hawke world, isn't it? Sort of. Picking the pomposity of empire, the dying empire. I mean, that whole era does that quite a lot, doesn't it?
And of course, he's repeating his role from one of my favourite films, Kind Hearts and Coronets, where he's the jailer.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. And obviously, it's got the clangers in it, which is just quite.
It does.
But works brilliantly.
Clive Morton is also in a wonderful episode of Dial 999, the very early 60s, late 50s police series, which starred Clive Morton was also in a fabulous episode of the 1950s police series, Dial 999, which starred Robert Beatty out of the 10th Planet. And this particular episode also has Patrick Barr to the moon base. And Patrick Barr sends Robert Beatty to track down a murderer who's Clive Morton. And it ends up with this fantastic, the slowest chase on record as they escape on the slowest motorboat you can imagine on the River Thames, pursued by Robert Beatty on foot on the bank until the boat crashes and Colonel Trenchard is drowned in the river.
So, oh, man.
Yeah, it's worth looking at.
Those episodes still available?
Oh, yeah.
You were bigger fish than I'd ever of vintage British telly, aren't you?
Well, I love a bit of vintage telly. It was released by the now sadly lamented network a few years ago, two or three years ago. So it's still around, darling, and it's still findable. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
So if I'm going to watch the Sea Devils, if I'm going to sit down and watch the Sea Devils, I'll watch the full length version. Of course I will.
Yeah.
But I particularly chose the omnibus this time because that meant so much to me in sort of getting me going as a Doctor Who watcher, not a Doctor Who viewer, but not yet probably a Doctor Who fan at that stage.
Yeah, no, it's interesting when it just sort of when it just becomes part of your DNA, then, doesn't it? And then anything that's related.
Well, that came much later for me.
The DNA of Doctor Who, the Philip Hinchcliffe years, edited by Gary Russell.
Doing this book with Philip Hinchcliffe, and I'm editing it, but the idea spurred on originally from Philip.
It's a collection of essays. Each one is on one of my stories, and it'll be opinions, views, maybe critical opinions. I've spoken to people, over many hours, so they've kind of got my views on things now as much as I can remember it, but I think there'll be a lot of new stuff in it.
Everyone's individual essays are very unique and very different, and then each of them is prefaced by a little piece by Philip, and these things have been absolute joys as they come in because they're not what we expected, they're so much better.
I recorded my thoughts about the programme a long time ago and fortunately still had those, so they have provided, you know, background for a lot of the writers.
He's almost answering the previous 30 years worth of articles and reviews that have been written. It's interesting because it's all new material and it's stuff Philip hasn't said before.
It's going to be a different kind of book that's been written, I think, about Doctor Who.
Classic Doctor Who, new perspectives. From Roundel Books and Cutaway Comics, out in August 2024. See cutawaycomics.co.uk for more details.
Choosing next, I was going to go into the Web of Fear, but I think since you've sort of mentioned your sort of, you know, your sort of more gradual than other people journey to being a fan. When I was at Hooverville a few years back, I remember saying to you, I've not really been to very many conventions, and you said you didn't go to one until you were 42, I think you said.
42, yeah. Yes, it's bizarre, isn't it?
I know, it's because as I said in the intro, you are very well known for not just Hooverville, but organising, you know, Big Finish have trusted you with their events, and you've done some brilliant stuff for the Doctor Who Appreciation Society. I think, am I right? You organised the Terence Dix appreciation.
Well, yeah, that's the only thing I've done with Dwas. I mean, I always go to Dwas Panopticon, which I think is a brilliant, not Panopticon, what I'm talking about, Dwas the Capital, organised by Tony Jordan, who's a great convention organiser. I think it's a lovely little convention.
Yeah.
And I always go down there to help out, and I'll steward a bit and the rest of it. But the Terence Dix event. It was not long after Terence had died that Paul Cornell asked us, the Hoovers Group, and Dwas to co-organise an event in Terence's memory. And he, Paul Cornell, who was a big fan of Terence, a big friend of Terence, in fact, had been to Hooverville and seen what we did and thought we were quite good at organising events. But Dwas also had that imprimatur of like almost the official fan club, as it were. So it felt right that we should do that together. And we did, but that was a long road because COVID happened, and the date we'd picked to organise it was the week that COVID, the lockdown started. Our event should have been on the Sunday, and lockdown happened the following week. So that was cancelled and postponed, and we finally got there after the lockdowns, and we had a lovely day at the Riverside studios in London, because we always organize our events in Derby, you see. We don't travel well, but we did make an exception and helped organize that. It was an absolutely lovely day.
I wish I could have gone to that, but it just sounded, I mean, your lineup of people that, I mean, this is testament to you guys, also testament to Terence Dix.
To Terence, testament to Terence, absolutely.
You got, Stephen Moffat came,
yeah,
and sort of all manner of sort of big hitters came.
Absolutely. And Stephen was Stephen was interviewed by Robert Dick, who is a good friend of ours and has been an absolute rock of Hooverville since the very beginning.
Yeah, I love Robert.
And that interview that Robert did with Stephen Moffat, I think that's the best convention interview I've ever seen. I wish it'd been recorded and bugged up on YouTube or something, because it was a superb interview.
Yeah. And did that lead to Stephen enjoying it? And then that's why he then was part of the reason he was then at the Capitol, and he was brilliant at the Capitol as well.
Well, I suspect it would have been, yeah. That was the one year I wasn't able to go to the Capitol, unfortunately, because my wife was poorly.
You know, I was in the room and I think everyone was talking about, I think that's right, it was even more, I mean, obviously it's Stephen Moffat, so everyone was really keen to watch it, because they'd heard how great it was at the Turnstix event as well.
Well, I did, of course, I approached him with the idea of coming to Hooverville as well. And he didn't say no to me. He said, ask nearer the time. But I should do so, shouldn't I? Because I'm sure he was just meaning, when he said ask nearer the time, I'm sure what he actually meant was shut up and go away and stop bothering me. But
You can but ask. What I hear is he really enjoyed the process and he really enjoyed it at Capitol.
Brilliant. I met him years ago at the only previous convention he'd done as a guest, which was Dimensions in Stockton-on-Tees, where he had a horrible time. And he just wasn't buying into the idea, I'm afraid, and didn't quite know how to approach the idea of being a guest there, and was very grumpy. And
what year was that? Was he showrunner then?
No, it was after, it would have been 2 or 3 years into the new series, after he'd established a reputation as being the best writer on the new series.
Yeah. Well, that's strange.
But I wasn't at that stage showrunner.
Yeah, and then he kept well away when he was showrunner.
Oh, which is fair enough.
When I loved his tweets when it was announced that Russell T. Davis was coming back. He just put a tweet out saying, Russell T. Davis must resign. So get the fan hating early.
So coming back to what you said, I was 42 before I went to a convention. The big sort of moment for me was the early 90s, and particularly the 30th anniversary, when there was a repeat season, wasn't there? Which we spoke about before, and I very much enjoyed that. I was living down in Essex at the moment. I was teaching in a school in Essex. I was a teacher for 30 years before I retired, of modern languages. And Chelmsford Library, God bless them, had the most fantastic collection of VHS tapes, including all the Doctor Who ones that had been released at that time, and they kept getting the new ones. So it was absolutely fabulous. And so I would take out these, I would be buying VHS tapes as well. I'd be buying, making up my own collection of Doctor Who VHS tapes. And at the same time, I would be getting out VHS tapes from Chelmsford Library, taking them home, copying them. Chelmsford Library even kindly provided a colour photocopier, so I could copy the covers. So I very rapidly amassed a very big collection of Doctor Who VHSs. I did also then buy the ones I'd copied and replaced my knockoff copies. So I don't feel bad about that, really.
Well, I mean, Doctor Who has a long history of piracy.
Yeah.
That's the reason we still have some of these.
Absolutely right.
I think you find your
way. Absolutely. Like I say, I did buy
the soundtrack off the TV.
yeah. Quite right. But I did buy them, and I started buying Doctor Who magazine at around that time as well, because I'd been buying Red Dwarfs magazine and loving that. And then all of a sudden there was an announcement in one issue that that's the last one, and any more coming. So I sort of had a look around and, what shall I buy now? Because I've been enjoying reading this. And then just happened to notice, I remember it very clearly, in Colchester, W.H. Smith's, I saw a copy of DWM. Hartnell on the cover, and I thought, that's where I'm going for this one. So it was the Gary Russell years, the editor at the time, and I sort of think buying DWM is quite a big signifier of being a fan. I think,
that's the era that the era I remember is when I was young and I loved the Absalom Dac 70s years, because I was I was a kid, you know, sort of Dead Skin and all those the weekly years. And then those other years where I was at university, and that's when Gary, weirdly, was the first person to pay me to write for A Brief Encounter, which never got published.
Oh, brilliant. I was just that bit too old, you see, because at that stage, I mean, what? In early 90s, I was into my 30s. So I was too young to belong to that group of fans who were writing their adventures and that sort of thing. I was younger than some people who wrote them, of course I was, but I wasn't connected with that group, and not being in London or this, that and the other. I know that Virgin New Adventures and then the BBC books were open to taking proposals, weren't they, for books? And every year I told myself, right, I'll send one in this year, and I just never got around to it.
Your 30s tend to not be the decade for doing things like that. More when you're at uni and you're just getting going, or
when you're tired. In fact, what little time I had as a published writer, a professional published writer, was in my 40s. So
that's the way. Maybe it's just when things settle down, or there are no.
Yeah, the way it works.
One of your choices is Hooverville itself.
Let's do Hoovers first before we do Hooverville.
Yeah, so do you want to do Hoovers?
I've done local groups, haven't I?
I was going to say, so Doctor Who local groups.
Yeah.
Your definition of that, or quite how you take this into a bunker, I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I've absolutely no idea. It's an odd thing that sort of at the early 2000s, the East Midlands, where I live, became something of a hotbed for local Doctor Who local groups. Now, all that means is local Doctor Who fans gathering together, often in pubs or in social clubs or whatever, and spending the evening together or whatever. I was very lucky to discover that I live in Derbyshire. I moved to Derbyshire in 1995. Mm-hmm. And then around about 2000, having it's built up this Doctor Who fandom thing, and I hadn't been to a convention. I was to do that later that year, but in 2000 I thought, well, you know, I've been reading DWM all these years, I'm enjoying this now, I think I'd quite like to find out about other Doctor Who fans, because in those days you would get convention reports in DWM and they looked quite fun. They looked quite fun. So, okay, maybe this is for me. So I used to go into a second-hand book and DVD, no, it'd be book and VHS stall in Derby Market called Eons Books, Eons Records, something like that, one or the other. IONS, Eons. And I went in there one day and I said, you don't happen to know if there's a Doctor Who fan group around here at all, do you? Because I knew he was a fan. And he said, now then, young man. Well, I wasn't. I was quite old. Now then. As it happens, I've just been given this, and he produces a flyer from the Hoovers group, which had just been established. Now, the Hoovers group had its first meeting on November the 23rd, 1999. But there'd been a long history of Doctor Who fan groups in Derby, apparently. I knew nothing of this. Whotopia was probably the longest lasting. And that had finished in the early 90s because people just sort of got tired of doing that. But a lot of the key people had stayed in touch with each other and involved, and because they'd become friends, I mean, as how it worked, they'd become good friends. And by the late 90s, two or three of them had decided, right, we want to set up another group. We want to get it going again because we enjoyed what we did 10, 15 years ago. Let's try it again. So they set up this group, the Hoovers. And early 2000, I was given this flyer and I rang the number on it. And I spoke to a fellow called Gary Finney, who is still a very good friend of mine, who was in charge of the group at that stage, and went along to the first meeting. And the first meeting that was available after then, they were meeting once a month in a sort of a community hall, arts centre type place. It would be a bit much to describe it as an arts centre. It was a community hall type place in Derby, and absolutely loved it. And there would have been somewhere around 20 people there, all Doctor Who fans. And we became friends. And people like, as I say, Gary and Steve Hardy, a friend of mine, Andrew Mark Thompson, who, of course, is now very well known for the book that he's just brought out this year and his work on Twitter.
Yeah,
I've met these people, Adam Richards, who later sadly died. Yeah, became great friends. And that's how that worked. Now, so that was the Hoovers. And then within, just over a year after I first joined the group, I loved that first year in the group because over the years, almost anything I've ever been involved in, I've ended up running it, which is lovely. But it was just nice just to be a consumer and to go along to the meetings, have a quiz, silly games, chat about Doctor Who, just sit back and take it all in and enjoy it. So 2001, summer 2001, the people who run it then, which was Steve Hardy and a fellow called Mitch Litherland, they said, stood up in the meeting and said, we're going to have to wind the group up, we think, because we don't want to run it anymore. And unless someone can come forward and agree to run the group, we're going to run it up. So we sort of all looked at each other and thought, this can't be right. We're really enjoying this. It'd be a shame to stop at this point. And I sort of sat there and, yeah, go on then, I'll do it. I found my hand going up almost beyond control. yeah, okay. So my first meeting running the Hoovers was September 2001, just ahead of which I had a phone call saying we couldn't use the building we'd been using anymore because there was some sort of... it was going to be used for something else. So I had to scrabble around and try and find somewhere else to meet. So we ended up meeting in a room in Derby Polish Club for a number of years. Yeah, so that was that. September 2001 was my first meeting. And I managed to get some guests. We had Paul Ebbs and Steve Johnson, who at that point were working for BBV. Who were producing their not quite Doctor Who audios and videos at that point. So they came up to Derby and did the meeting for us, which was great. And Paul is still a friend to this day, and I've been talking to him today as he happens. And that after that, we had a whole string of really good guests come into our meetings, and three or four times a year we'd have. I think the first person we had had actually been on the show was Annika. Annika Wills. Mm-hmm. The previous organiser of the group, Ian Farrington, had gone off to be Gary Russell's assistant at Big Finish. Gary had recruited him because the Hoovers group, we had a fanzine, which we produced, called Shock Ice Kitchen, which people may remember. It was a very well-regarded comedy fanzine, if you like. And Gary had seen this, and Ian had edited a number of issues and invited him to go off and work for him, which was great. And it meant that we got all sorts of contacts with people like Gary and Nick Briggs and Rob Shearman and people like that all came up to the Hoovers group. We had Annika, as I say. Annika at a convention introduced me to Sophie, so Sophie Aldred came. And we just ended up getting a whole lot of really good people, often with the help of Derek Hambley from 10th Planet, who brought several guests to some of our meetings. And the Phantom Boys as well brought some guests to some of our meetings as well. We had a very good relationship with both of those. Yeah, so that's that. And at the same time as we were doing that, fully organised meetings with guests or with quizzes and with games and with all sorts of activities, not just sitting around watching a video. We did that as well, of course. Groups started up in Nottingham and in Leicester. So we had three very active groups in the East Midlands, and some of us would go to the Nottingham group and the Leicester group as well, and they would come to us if we got something special on. We found fans were coming down from Sheffield, which is not too far away from us, and even occasionally from Leeds and so on. And Stoke, people were coming across from Stoke to some of our meetings. There were times when we would have a Friday night meeting, and we'd got a guest, and we'd have 80 or 90 people there, which is pretty extraordinary. Mm. And even if it was just a meeting without a guest, where it was just us sitting around being silly and chatting and playing games and things, we would regularly get 30 people in those days, which is was terrific. Sadly, I think the day of the local group has sort of passed a bit, because people communicate these days like we're doing now over Zoom, and what we do now, the attendance had started to drop off at our monthly meetings, and we were regularly getting sort of, I don't know, 10 to a dozen or things like that sort of number, rather than the 30 we used to get. And it became financially a bit silly for us to be paying for a room to do that. And we didn't want to meet in a pub because that meant kids couldn't come and that sort of thing. We wanted it to be a more welcoming sort of atmosphere. So what we do these days is we meet twice a month, once in person, and that is probably normally only about half a dozen people. We meet in the bar at Quad, which is our great venue in Derby, which I'm sure we'll talk more about. And the other meeting is a Zoom meeting. And we get people from all over the country and occasionally from even abroad. So our local group is wherever people happen to be local to. It's changed. Things have changed, haven't they? So.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And then, so when did the Hoovers turn into Hooverville?
Well, it didn't. Hoovers still carried on, very much so. Yeah. And for a long time, we regarded, I suppose I still do, regard the group as our, I don't like to say core business, but our main activity. You know, that was what we did. We were a local group. We organized a meeting once a month. We had a guest every so often. And we were doing that not long before the COVID lockdown happened. We were still doing that. Proper organized meeting. But the first Hooverville was in 2009 because we'd had quite a few guests come along to Hoover's meetings as described. And we'd got all these contacts and we looked at each other and said, you know, we ought to organize a convention. Oh, we should write a convention. Okay, let's do that then. How can we do this without without having any money? Well, so we came up with a great scheme, actually. And I'm still sort of amazed that it worked. A, I'm amazed it worked. And B, I'm amazed that more people don't do it because it does work. And what we did is we found a venue. And how we found a venue for the first couple of Hoovervilles, the same Ian Farrington who had gone off to work for Big Finish, his mum was working for a heritage railway outside of Derby, a place called Ripley. And they were looking for events to organise, to put on in their engine shed. And they did a rock festival, and they did Thomas the Tank Engine and all this sort of thing. And they quite liked the idea of doing a Doctor Who day. So we went to them and said, look, here's our offer, here's our thought. We will organise the event for you. We'll get the guests, we'll run the day, we'll do everything that needs to be done. You can just leave it to us. You provide the money, you provide the budget for it. And somewhat to my surprise, they went for that. And the first two Hooverville, first Hooverville, well, we had Colin Baker come. We got in touch with Colin and he came and was great headliner for our first event. And the if you like, the undercard was made up of people that we'd already got contacts with. We had Gary Russell and we had Nick Briggs. And we had Cheryl Hall, who played Sherna in Carnival of Monsters. Now, Cheryl's an interesting story. She's not done many Doctor Who events. In 2008, the year before our first Hooverville, I changed schools. I moved to a different school. And I was teaching I moved to a school in Chesterfield, in the north of Derbyshire. And I went for the interview and I sat in the staff room and I was chatting with one or two of the staff there. And I hadn't got the job at this stage. I was offered it later in the day. And this woman was in the staff room and I don't know, the subject of Doctor Who came up, as it does with Doctor Who fans when we're taken off guard. And and she said, oh, I did a Doctor Who. I beg your pardon. What do you mean you did a Doctor Who? I hated to think what she might mean. He said, yeah, I'm an actress. I said, yeah, go on, who are you then? I don't know. I don't recognize. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. She said, yes, I was in Carnival of Monsters. I played Sherna. I said, were you Cheryl Hall? Yes. Cheryl Hall at that stage had wasn't acting quite so much. She was still doing a bit, but not so much. She'd been the Labour leader of Kent County Council and had wanted a change of scenery and had moved to Derbyshire and had wanted to change a job and was working as a teaching assistant in the school where I was. So, yeah, her cover lessons were brilliant. She used to put on Carnival of Monsters for the kids to watch, which was terrific. Yeah, so Cheryl came. It's bizarre, isn't it, how you do find people and meet people? Yeah, it's bizarre how you come across people with connections to Doctor Who. I mean, I know Toby Haydock says a similar thing, that Doctor Who keeps haunting him in his life. In the tiny village in Derbyshire where I live, One of my neighbors is a guy called Tristan Peatfield, who was a production designer on Doctor Who in around about 2000, and that would have been 2011, I'm going to say. It was between Ed Thomas and Michael Pickwode. So there was sort of a brief interregnum between those two, and he was in charge then. He worked in the art department for a lot of years. So he lives over there. He lives down there. And then my next door neighbour, her cousin, was in Warriors of the Deep. So what can you do? Yes, her cousin is Tara Ward. My neighbour's cousin is Tara Ward that was in Warriors of the Deep. So in just a tiny village in Derbyshire. Some of my Hoover's mates have referred to it as Stella Street.
The Doctor Who.
It is bizarre. But yeah, I've seen about the three different Doctor Who groups, and they were all different because there was also a really sort of organised and doing activities. There was the Nottingham group who had a private room in a pub and did quizzes, but were not quite as into doing activities and things like that as we were. And then there was the Leicester group who basically just met in a pub and chatted, which is great, which is sort of what we do now. There was one occasion with the Nottingham group where the pub they were in, because it's right opposite the theatre in Nottingham, and in walked Susanna York, Michael Jayston, and there'd have been someone else, and I can't remember who, it doesn't matter. But the key was Michael Jayston, who I'd met before. So we were in the meeting of Doctor Who fans, and I approached Michael. I said, "We met so and so." Yes, yes. He was at Hooverville this year. Was Michael Jayston? So these connections these connections keep going. So yeah, Michael, the Doctor Who group, the Nottingham Doctor Who group, is in this the room through there. Would you mind awfully just coming and saying hello to them? So I took Michael into the meeting there, into the Valyard, into the Doctor Who group meeting. And they had no idea what to say to him. They went all shy and clammed up and looked quite embarrassed and wished he'd go away. So three totally different groups, totally different atmospheres, totally different philosophies behind our three groups. And but that was lovely.
The Warp group in Manchester, still, I hardly ever get to go myself because I live out in Cheshire. But they still meet without fail.
They do. They do, don't they, at the Britain's Protection.
In the Britain's Protection. And like you were saying, I mean, everything we're doing with Cutaway, in a way, comes out of Gareth starting that meeting having his own pub for years and then running his own little cons in the pub, but like parallel to
And
now we've got Cutaway Comics.
The Leeds group is still very active. Thank heavens they changed their name. They're now called the Yorkshire Whovians. For a few years they were called the Leeds Hooters, which I felt wasn't very appropriate. But they're a lovely bunch. They are absolutely lovely, and they still meet very regularly on a Saturday in a pub in Leeds. So that's but Gareth's pub, the Lass of Gowrie.
Yeah,
I remember when we bought a minibus trip up to see the Doctor Who exhibition in the Museum of Science and Industry or whatever it's called in Manchester, in Castlefields. And what we arranged with Gareth is that after we'd been around the meeting, we would go to the Lass and he'd lay on some sandwiches and stuff for us, lay on a Jeep. And so we had a little, and we arrived at the exhibition and bumped into Rob Shearman immediately and went around, sort of around the exhibition with Rob, which was lovely. And Steve Lyons was there, I remember, one or two other people. And we all descended en masse back to the Lass afterwards and had a great, we basically had a Hoover's meeting at the Lass.
The Lass was like such a special few years. I mean, it totally changed the lives of me, so many people. It just, you know, just it wasn't sure. Just I mean, I guess the same way you're you know, great friends of all the people you've known. And that's one of the amazing things about fandom, isn't it?
You go there for the start, and this is why I picked Doctor Who local groups actually. Is you go there initially because you have this shared love of this silly TV show, and you find all sorts of other things to talk about and all sorts of people who you share something with. And I mean, you know, not everybody you meet at a Doctor Who local group is going to be your best friend for life, but there's certainly some very lasting friendships. What I loved about it was that certainly at the Hoover's group, nobody took it very seriously. That, you know, it wasn't all po-faced, oh, this, that, oh, yes, doctor, this, and then he's visited the Cybermen and so, serious. No, it was taking the mick out of it. If a story was a bit ropey, people would laugh about it and tell us why it was ropey and enjoy the fact that it was ropey, which was wonderful. It was great.
Yeah.
And I think that was inevitable with the personnel involved in the Hoovers. I mean, we mentioned Andrew Mark Thompson and that bizarre sense of humour that he's got.
For people that don't know, Andrew Mark Thompson, I'll have to get him on here, actually. But he's just wonderful. How would you describe it? Sort of merchandise that never was.
Merchandise that never was, exactly.
Yeah. And just absolutely and his hilarious.
Book, It's a Fake.
Yeah, It's a Fake is his book. It's absolutely brilliant. And for me, my personal favourite, I don't know why, it just really tickled me when I first saw it on Twitter, was the Doctor Who themed thimbles. And I just couldn't get out. I actually thought they were real and wanted to get them for my mum.
This is it. And you see some bizarre merchandise that's been put out, and your first thought is always, is this one of Andy's?
Yeah. No, it's absolutely brilliant.
But it's not just Doctor Who stuff. The sapphire and steel ice lolly with the stainless steel stick.
Which
the advert he did for that, which ended up in Joanna Lumley's tour brochure.
Right, I remember him saying, brilliant. And
excellent stuff.
But he's done some stuff for us as well on the
on the
back of Demons of Eden. So
and there was a fellow called Adam Richards who died quite early on. Adam would have died. I don't know. He didn't live to see the new series. So he died before 2005, didn't he? Adam, again, was a wicked, naughty, funny person. He was one of the funniest people you could ever come across. And he was somebody who inhabited Rekart's Doctor Who and was very well known for his biting wit and satire on Rekart's Doctor Who in the early 2000s. And we lost him far too young. It's a sad thing. But, with people like Adam and Andy knocking around, it was never going to be too serious. It was always going to be good fun.
No, it's certainly. And I wonder if that all feeds into why Hooverville certainly seems to be, to my experience, seems to be one of the ones everyone loves. Like, the talent love doing it, and the fans love going to it. It's always one of the warmest.
It's exactly as we wanted to do it.
Very non-corporate, which is brilliant, and that comes right from the inception of. We're not doing this.
It is
the money side yourself.
We're a fan group. Yeah. Well, we don't keep money from ticket sales, because we did these 2 years at the railway, and then that became difficult. But we did it on a Sunday, an hour's bus ride out of Derby, which was probably silly for a start. But even so, Hooverville 2, we ended up with getting on for 150 odd people there, if I remember rightly. And it was in the engine shed, and it was a brilliant place to have a convention, because people would arrive one end of the line, catch a steam train down to the other end, and all pile off, and the convention was in the engine shed. But there were certain logistical difficulties, particularly, as I say, an hour's bus ride out of Derby on a Sunday, which wasn't ideal. And then we found the second year we did it. See, we used to have to go in on the Saturday and like sweep the engine shed and erect the stage and that sort of thing, which is fine because it wasn't a proper venue for that. So, you know, we knew we'd have to do that. But we went there on the Saturday, and they were painting a diesel locomotive in the engine shed. So the spray paint and all the rest of it, the masks on and all that. Okay, right. So I said to the fellow in charge, this whopping great diesel locomotive that they're spray painting in the engine shed, that won't be here tomorrow, will it? Of course not, because we've got this all to ourselves. Yes, it'll be here all weekend. They'll be spray painting that. So Hooverville 2 went on, let's say, under a cloud, and the cloud was toxic fumes of spray paint. there were virtually people floating out.
You actually did it with the shed, with the train in the shed.
Yes. Yes, they were down one end of the engine shed, and we were at the other end. And because the only way we could possibly have done it was leaving all the doors open, people were wandering in and out. It had nothing to do with us. They were just visiting the railway. And so we had no control over who was coming in or out. So, oh, I don't know.
Yeah. So
But so we decided to move. And luckily, we'd got this new wonderful arts centre, cinema, gallery, all the rest of it in the centre of Derby, which is Quad, which is a charity run by a charity. And we'd got one of our chaps, Adam Marsh, who was the cinema programmer at Quad. He's still there. He's in charge of all the films in the cinemas at Quad. So we spoke to Adam about it and said, well, what about if we move it to Quad? Same financial arrangement. You give us a budget. You take all the ticket receipts. We'll make what money we can on our stall, and we get a share of photo money and that sort of thing. But basically, Quad take the revenue, so we don't risk anything really when it comes down to it. So, and it's worked really, really well, and we've had some fabulous guests over the years. I mean, I mean, I don't want to talk figures, but our budget is not huge, and our total budget for Hooverville would not pay for David Tennant's left little finger. We have no chance whatsoever of getting new series doctors to Hooverville. We know that. That's off the table. We won't get new series companions. The sort of money that these people can command, and good luck to them, by the way, good luck to them, is not anywhere near our budget. But we can stretch to classic series doctors and companions, and we can also we've also managed to attract some nice high profile new series guests. Like we've had Adjoa Arando, Martha's mum. We've had Michelle Ryan, who was Lady Christina, and people like that. David, with the great David Warner, we've had at
Oh,
Hooverville,
we should have seen
which
that.
is
I
oh,
should have met David
fantastic.
Warner. But
Ah, we were warned with David Warner before he came that the one thing you must not do with David Warner is you must not tell him he's any good. You must not put him on a pedestal. You must not tell him how fantastic he is or anything like that. Yeah, we know he is. He's David Warner, but you mustn't tell him that. So yes, we had to be very circumspect about that. And it was not long after John Hurt had died, and John Hurt was a patron of Quad, and the cinema there is named after him, the John Hurt Cinema, and so on. And he was a big mate of David Warner, and I was chatting to him. The subject of John Hurt came up, and he was saying what a great actor John Hurt was because he was a character actor, who was also a leading actor, and all the rest of it. And I just completely innocently said, oh, you've not done too badly yourself in that respect. You're pretty much the same sort of thing. No, not at all, not at all. I had to backpedal so quickly in case I accidentally said something nice about him. But he was a lovely man. He was a lovely
Yeah,
man.
I wish I'd met him. I was lucky enough to meet. I interviewed John Hurt, so I've got that in my memory bank.
Oh, fantastic.
So I interviewed him before he was in Doctor Who. So it was for V for Vendetta of all things, and it was just wonderful because he was similarly. It's almost like he was a bit embarrassed to be being interviewed. So he kept turning it into a conversation where he'd end up talking to me about my life and stuff. And as a journalist, it's just nice. And then you go, oh, actually, no, never. I'm not going to use any of the stuff about me. Back to John Hurt. But yeah, but my he was just absolutely everything I want, because I was a massive fan of his. He's been in some of my most, Midnight Express, Elephant
I
Man.
Claudius.
Oh, and I Claudius, of course, which is one of my what we were talking about before.
Yeah,
I Claudius is like. I Claudius is kind of equal with Doctor Who in my
absolutely.
life. Absolutely love it.
Well,
Music.
we never had him at Hooverville, but Quad got him, because Quad do the Derby Film Festival as well, and one year he was there doing a talk and being interviewed by Tony Earnshaw, who did a great job
Oh, I know. I'm
interviewing
friends with Tony. I know
him.
Tony.
He did a great job interviewing him, and I was able to grab him with an armful of photographs for him to sign afterwards, which he was very very patient with me. I think he signed about half a dozen photographs. So.
Yeah, no, he's wonderful. I always say, when he became the War Doctor, I said I met him in I met him for V for Vendetta. I knew then he was going places.
They had Waris Hussein as well, whether it was the same year or another
Oh,
year
lovely
at the
Waris.
Derby Film Festival. Yes, but again, somebody we've not managed to get to Hooverville, but so that's been nice. Those
Yeah,
things
well,
have.
for people that don't know, Quad is such a lovely venue, and
It is, isn't
that's
it?
another reason why Hooverville is something. It's kind of what on our permanent list for Cutaway now. An annoying.
Good.
I can't go next time because.
Oh no!
I was on my way. I was on my way to Hooverville, going this one just gone. The last one you did, and I was on my way going, oh, I'm excited. So I thought, oh, I'll listen to that interview with Stephen Hatcher. I can't remember which podcast it was.
It was wasn't it Type 40?
Yeah, that's right. Who then we met at the conference. Yeah, so I interviewed them. I listened to that podcast and I was going, oh, that's good. And then during that you say, oh, but this next year it's on the 31st of August, which is my son's birthday. So, sorry. Can't go to Hooverville unless he does like Doctor Who, but I don't.
Bring him.
And my grandmother.
Birthday present.
Yes.
Birthday present. Yeah. Ticket.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk. Or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.
Your next choice is we'll go for Web of Fear.
Okay.
Which is a brilliant story. Are you like a lot of us? Did you like this and then go absolutely fall back in love with it when the missing episodes were rediscovered?
Well, there's two. Things with Web of Fear really for me. I didn't see it in the 60s, of course, because I was watching professional wrestling from Wolverhampton or something like that at the time. But it was that single first episode that survived was the last surviving episode that I watched during that period in the 90s between Tomb of the Cybermen coming back and what was next, Crusade, wasn't it, The Lion? Yeah, I mean, during that period of the 90s, that was the last one I saw. It was the point where I said, right, I've seen all the episodes that now exist. I was very much into the loose canon reconstructions in the 90s and the early 2000s. And I became a dub site, as was called for them. If you remember how it used to work, is that people used to have to send off VHS tapes to a nominated dub site who would then copy these reconstructions for them and send back the VHS tapes to them. And I became sort of the lead dub site for Loose Canon, because I copied out the copies that went to the dub sites, as well as doing them for the people who'd sent the tapes. So that was nice. So yeah, that was I saw episode one of the Web of Fear as part of the Loose Canon reconstruction on the same tape as that. But the reason I chose it was that moment 10 years ago when it came back I'd known from the reconstruction that it was going to be an absolutely lovely story, and from the soundtrack, which was released on CD, wasn't it, that it was going to be a great story. And blow me down, it didn't disappoint at all. And I know some people were blown away by The Enemy of the World and how unexpectedly brilliant that was, which it was. And it was a surprise that was as good as it was, because even Barry Letts, who directed it, had told us it was rubbish when he came to Hoover's meeting. He said, yes, I really made a mess of that one in slightly stronger language. which he didn't. And isn't it sad that he died before it came back, so he didn't realise that he hadn't made a mess of it. Yeah. I think that was very sad, that.
Yeah.
But yes, Enemy of the World was great, but the Web of Fear for me was just perfect. I mean, it's a story that doesn't bear a great deal of scrutiny in terms of plot logic. I mean, why Yetis in London? I can see Yetis in the Himalayas. That sort of makes sense. If you're the great intelligence, if you're sitting up there being intelligent and you think, right, I'm going to invade the Earth, where shall I invade it from? I know, the Himalayas. I'll start with that monastery there, and then I'll today debt send, tomorrow the world. So he booked his ideas up after that. And went for one of the biggest cities in the world. Right, okay, London. Right, I'm going to invade London. My Yetis can... No intelligence. Why do you want your Yetis? No, do something different from Yetis this time. Yeah. They were great in the Himalayas. They're not ideal. I'm going to stick them in the underground.
Yeah, they're using a web.
They're what, sorry?
And they're using a web.
They're using a web, yes, which is... And they're using the London Underground. Why? I mean, we now know why, because we now know that it was because Matt Smith gave Richard E. Grant a tin with a map of the London Ground on it, and he went, ha-ha!
Well, one thing I love about it, it's so intricately plotted over all these decades.
Oh, yeah. But it doesn't bear any scrutiny at all. None whatsoever.
No.
But who cares? It's great. Yeah. Nick Courtney, of course. Nick Courtney's first appearance as the Brigadier. Nick Courtney, we never managed to get to work with Hoovers, either at a Hoovers meeting or Hooverville. I'd accosted him at a Dimensions convention, and I knew he was doing a thing in Sheffield on a Saturday at Galaxy 4 shop. So I'd arranged for him to come to us on the Friday night before we went up to Sheffield on the Saturday. And that was all arranged, and that was what was going to happen. But unfortunately, family circumstances came up and he wasn't able to come. So we missed the chance to work with Nick Courtney, which is very sad because he was lovely. We did later get to work with Ralph Watson, who played Captain Knight in The Web of Fear. And we had him for a Hoover's meeting and for Hooverville. And he was utterly lovely. We really enjoyed his company. Such a smashing man, great raconteur. Sadly, died not long after he came to us at Hooverville. Died the following year, so very sad. But very much missed Ralph Watson. But great story. Patrick Troughton, of course. The Troughton Doctor is still my favourite. It's still, even though I saw very little of him at the time, subsequently discovered the Troughton Doctor, and what an actor that man was. And you see any television of the 50s or 60s, at some point Patrick Troughton will crop up and he'll be there.
Well, my main memory of him is knowing I was watching a Doctor Who, but when the Box of Delights was on.
Wonderful.
But yeah, Web of Fear and Patrick Troughton are amongst my favourite things now. But yeah, Lapsy, Web of Fear, might well be on my list as well. It's absolutely, just love Base Under Siege apart from anything else. Simple pleasures.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just works.
Absolutely. Works so well. Yes. And of course, we've worked with Fraser a fair few times as well. Because he lives not that far away from us. And so, relatively easy to tempt Fraser over.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you.
Gods and Monsters. Issue 1, Fausti. Written by Stephen Gallagher with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh. Written by Ian Winterton with art by Adrian Salmon. And issue 3, Omega El Trala by Mark Griffiths with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space.
If we come on to your last choice now, we've got obviously you like Big Finish, you've written for Big Finish, and
in a very minor way. Now let's not overplay this. I wrote 5 short stories for the Short Trips anthologies.
Well, yeah,
so
still,
yeah,
I mean, my
contribution to Big Finish in terms of writing has been quite minimal.
What I was saying is so I take it that you have supped quite deeply from the Big Finish audio cup. Have you?
They have supped quite deeply from my wallet. Your, certainly.
Yes.
I got into during the 90s. I was driving quite a lot to visit people in different parts of the country on a regular basis and so on. So I got into listening to stuff on audio in the car and so on. And Star Trek talking books were a big part of that and so on. And then, of course, there was the two Pertwee radio plays, radio series from
the
Paradise of Death and the Ghosts of Endspace from the early 90s, one of which is great and one of which is less than great. And the two Blake Seven ones as well, that for some reason they asked Barry Letts to write. Yeah, okay. Well, it's not quite the Blakestone I remember, but never mind. But yeah, so that was great. And then I got into Bill Baggs's BBV releases that he got, and I had those very regularly when they came out. I think I got all of those at the time. And then one day there was this announcement that this company called Big Finish were going to be doing The Adventures of Bernice Summerfield. Now, I'd not really got very deeply into the new adventures. I started reading the Doctor Who novels, I think in 97. I think I started buying and reading the Virgin New Adventures just as they'd stopped being produced.
Yeah, well, they stopped. The McGann film.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So I had to spend an absolute fortune on getting hold of them. and watch them. Yeah. So Big Finish started with the Bernice ones. And I bought those first Bernice releases. Oh No It Isn't and Beyond the Sun. I think it was about four of them, weren't there, that were just Bernice. And I bought them on cassette, and I later got them on CD, and then that wonderful announcement that they were making Doctor Who, and they got licensed to do Doctor Who. And Sirens of Time, the first release, and I just could not believe what I was hearing. For me, Doctor Who didn't come back in 2005 with Rose. It came back in 1999, was it? With the Sirens of Time. That for me was the return of Doctor Who, because it was performed Doctor Who. It didn't matter too much that it wasn't the latest Doctor or an ongoing continuation of the Doctor Who story, although that came, of course, once they signed McGann, which was another wonderful point, and that was only in 2000. That was only a year later. So, absolutely wonderful. Nice. And that first, just hearing Davison doing Doctor Who again. It was Davison's voice in particular. Somehow, because we'd heard Colin and we'd heard Sylvester doing Bill Baggs's stuff, but we never heard Peter do it before. We did a couple of videos for Baggs, but there he was playing the Doctor on The Sirens of Time, and that was fantastic. I have bought every Doctor Who release from Big Finish ever since those days, including all the spin-offs. And it did come to a point the other year where I had to make a decision.
Reinforced floor for you.
Well, it's quite awkward. But it came to a point that money was starting to be a bit tight and all that. And I said to myself, now look, you're going to have to just give up on something. So I stopped buying all the other ranges, because I was buying Star Cops and Callan and all those other wonderful releases they brought out. I said, look, this is silly. You're getting to hear them anyway. Go on, I'm on the reviewers list, so I get some free copies of the downloads anyway. Yeah. But I've been buying them all as well on top. Yeah. And I said, but Torchwood, they're actually the thing that I think Big Finish are doing just about the best at the moment. I think the Big Finish Torchwood range is wonderful. But I'm going to stop buying the CDs. So I'm download only for Torchwood now, sadly. But and for things like Star Cops, which I love. But yeah, so I've got all their Doctor Who stuff.
The amount of money I will have spent on Big Finish. But I also think there's so much of it that they obviously don't intend you to buy it all, much as they'd like you to buy it all. They don't intend you to buy it all. I just always think there's different streams that you can like. So I've just, the only ones I've never missed an episode of are the McGann, because to me that's the Eighth Doctor. That's his run, and especially when it was from. I liked it. I mean, I love McGann. He's possibly almost my favorite Doctor, and that's purely as a result, obviously, of Big Finish.
Yeah.
But I just loved it from, especially when it really went up when the show came back and they had the Sheridan Smith, Lucy Miller years and
on, wasn't it? Yeah.
And then Stranded recently. Was just phenomenal.
Great,
First season of that.
I really liked the early ones, the Charlie stories as well.
Oh yeah, I like them all. Yeah, but just very much. But there was something really, really cool about if they brought McGann back instead of casting Eccleston, you could really imagine it.
Yeah,
this is Sheridan Smith. Yeah. I still want to see. I still want to see Sheridan Smith and Nicola Walker rock up.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you have to watch Annika, don't you?
Yeah. No, I love Annika.
to
yeah,
see
no,
them
I was
together,
reading a
yeah.
thing. I was reading a thing with. In fact, it was at Hooverville, wasn't it? When McGann was saying, "Oh, everyone says." First thing me and Nicola said was, "They'll say we're filming a Doctor Who. You know what they're like. They'll be out there photographing." Nicola Walker.
But you can watch that series, and you can sort of imagine he's the Doctor, and that she's she's on.
The focus really quite hard onto the companion.
But there was that episode. Do you remember there was that episode of a series called Sea of Souls? It was a series called Sea of Souls. It was a bit like the Omega Factor, but less scary. It was made in Scotland, and it was Bill Paterson, and he was like a university-based psychic investigator. And in one of the episodes, McGann guest starred as this mysterious psychic figure who no one was quite sure who he was, and he sort of disappeared. And you didn't have to use that. This was before Doctor Who came back. It was actually produced by Phil Collinson. And you didn't have to do too much imagining to think this character is actually the Doctor. This is a missing Doctor Who episode.
Yeah, oh, brilliant. Yeah, I might have to seek that out. On me.
Yep, Sea of Souls.
Sea of Souls. That's the thing about doing this podcast. I've enlightened, at the very least, it gives me something to watch. Nearly every single time I end up having to make a purchase of something. So yeah, but I listened to Sirens of Time today. I don't think it was the first time, but this was certainly the first time. It might as well have been, because I couldn't remember much about it. And it's so strange. I just fired up the Spotify, and I've been meaning to like take advantage of the first 50 being on Spotify. And lo and behold, you recommend the first of the series, and I'm like, I think I'm now on the journey.
It's by no means the best of Big Finish. Of course it isn't. But it's just for the fact that it existed at that point in 1999. And
brilliant.
Doctor Who was back.
It's brilliant.
It's great.
What's so strange for me was how young their voices sound. Like we've got used because they've changed as we've got older as well. We've got used to their voices, but it was so strange hearing, oh yeah, that is how the Doctor used to sound.
Yeah. Yeah,
or
that's right.
I think he sounds more like the Doctor. Like Davison especially sounded so young. It's almost like he sounds more like the Doctor in later ones. Maybe he relearned how to do his Doctor voice, and he didn't quite do it in Sirens of Time.
This time last year, I re-listened to the whole of the run with the Sixth Doctor and Evelyn Smythe.
Oh, yeah.
For a piece I was writing.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very clever
what story. What a wonderful run that was.
Yeah.
And what a great character Evelyn was as well.
Very clever storyline. Never like to do spoilers of the Big Finish stuff, because I know TV episodes are probably fair game, but there's so much other material that people might not have heard. So keep them spoiler free.
Right from the Marion Conspiracy onwards, you've got a whole run of some of the very best stories that, in my view, Big Finish have ever done. Different in those days, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Before the new series came back, Big Finish was Doctor Who.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we were. I certainly re-listened to stories much more in those days than I do now. I think fandom in general was more aware of each month's new story. Well, of course, there were fewer of them that Big Finish were bringing out as well. It's not like these days where you maybe got three box sets a month coming out. That's quite a lot to keep up with and quite a lot to discuss with people. But if there was one monthly release like there was in those days, this month's release is such and such. What did you think of it? Then that was certainly a topic of conversation in those days.
It's a wonderful time, and one thing they deserve a sort of a medal for, apart from anything else, is they totally rehabilitated Colin Baker's Doctor, as he said himself. Like, I remember interviewing him, 2000, I think, and that's one of the first times I kind of heard about Big Finish, was from Colin Baker saying, well, the scripts when I was on the TV show were quite often a lot of rubbish, I remember him saying. But
he's not wrong.
But But he said, but what I'm doing now, Big Finish, is absolutely wonderful. And he's still doing them.
Well, I mean, you said quite right. I'd written some short stories for Big Finish. But mm-hmm. I mean, my contribution to Big Finish has been mostly as a consumer. Mm-hmm. But I am quite proud of the three Big Finish days that we organised with them, which we spoke also about. I mean, that's been absolutely lovely to have actually felt that we were contributing a bit to the Big Finish project, as it were. Because the last 20 years without Big Finish would have been pretty bleak.
Well, I think in like lots of ways, they really kept the flame alive. Like, not just a tiny bit, the flame was really pretty big. The fact that the news show came back and tapped straight into Russell went, you know, Russell went, okay, I'll have these Big Finish people.
And when you think about it,
Adventures and Big Finish between them.
When you think about it, the new series was the return of the new series was announced on the 26th of September 2003, mm-hmm. which was the day after my 45th birthday. I woke up on the morning after my birthday to discover Doctor Who was coming back. Best present I've ever had. Second best present I've ever had was it 2 years ago when on my birthday, 25th of September, it was announced that Russell was coming back to Doctor Who. So, two good birthday presents. But the point I was making was that's only 4 years of Big Finish being the main mm-hmm. player in town.
You've
only got those four years there, and so much did they make of those 4 years. Such gratitude to Russell T. Davis when the new series was getting underway, where he was asked, what do you want to do with this small company that we license the audios to, Big Finish? Should we shut them down? And apparently he said, no, just pass that over here, leave that to me, I'll sort that. That's fine. And he looked after them and made sure they kept the license and carried on going. And what a great job Gary Russell did in those early days as well as the executive producer. Fantastic run of stories, and really got the thing off to a great start, because he really understood what he was doing and understood how to make the success of it. And great credit too to Nick Briggs, who took over from him as well, and all the other people. But those two executive producers have been the perfect people to do that at the particular time. To do that.
And Jason Hager for allowing them to, like Gary said,
putting up the money.
His money. Gary was, met Jason and he was kind enough to let me spend all his money, which is brilliant. But yeah, it'd be a weird world, like you said, without Big Finish in it. For us Who fans.
Gary is one of the nicest people I've met through Doctor Who, I must say. He's an absolute
nice people, delight. Yeah, he really is. Yeah, I mean, the fact that we get to work with him, I'm his editor, technically, but he doesn't really need any editing. And he's also my editor on this Hinchcliffe book. I've written one of the things more. But he's doing this. I've read you. If you want to get into any comic, then his Inferno prequel, and then he's doing a three-book epic. Post Inferno, the TV thing, but Gary is just has written it. He loves Inferno, and so his idea for the Inferno prequel from 1940 up to the day before the Doctor arrives, and then
that does sound interesting.
But yeah, we've got John Ridgway doing the art on that, and it's going to be a special Gary Russell epic.
Sounds terrific.
Anyway, Stephen Hatcher, it has been an absolute pleasure to get and chatting to you.
Thank you very much for inviting me on, Ian.
That's all right. So we absolutely love Whoville. Well, and like I was saying, it's sort of one. It's become, we've got Gallifrey, Whoville, Capital, and they're kind of, they've sort of weirdly become the three things that we're probably never going to miss from now on. We're going to just always be at. Although in the case of the 31st of August, maybe not the next one. But Cutaway will be there. I will see you on Facebook and maybe at the next Hooverville, or I will see you at Capital.
Let's hope so. Good to talk to you, Ian.
So we'll see you. Right, good night.
Definitely Steve. Capital.
Yeah, cheers.
Bye. Bye.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton, produced by James Stevenson of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.